Joining me now is Adrienne Lauby. Most of you will be familiar with Adrienne because she's one of the hosts of Pushing Limits here on KPFA. And she's also a member of our Unpaid Staff Organization Council, which tries to make sure that those of us who do these shows and do other work here at the station without being paid have some input and representation and rights here at the station. So we really appreciate that. But we're here right now to talk about her work in Sonoma County on homelessness. The Sonoma County Task Force on Homelessness just recognized her with the Marika Bick Spirit of Community Award at their annual fundraising dinner. And this is not her first recognition for the work that she does on homelessness. Last year, the Sonoma County Peace and Justice Center recognized her as well with the Russ and Mary Jorgensen Courage of Commitment Award. So, Adrienne, thanks for coming in. And tell me how you got involved in all this work that you do, which is mainly with a group called Homeless Action in Sonoma. You're doing as a volunteer. How did you get involved in doing this work?
I got involved out of Occupy, because we had tents in Santa Rosa, and when you put up tents, homeless people come. There was quite a culture shock between the activists and the homeless people. And one of my friends who still works with me, Carolyn Eppel, knocked on my door one midnight night and said, "Oh, they're treating this man so badly. We have to do something." There was a moment there where the activists said, "Oh, no, we're not going to live in permitted tents," because the city had said, "We'll give you permits for your tents." "Oh, no, we won't do that. That's not radical. That's, you know, caving into the system." And the homeless people were like, "Yeah, give me a permit. let me have my tent." Well, the activists went home. The police swept the encampment, as they did everywhere. And we started having workshops for activists saying, this is the reality of mental illness. This is the reality of homelessness. This is some sort of hands-on how you deal with problems that come up between that. And it just continued. I started to get more and more involved. I started to go to some of the other organizations that were meeting, and including the people who gave me the award, the Task Force for the Homeless in Sonoma County.
I think a lot of us don't necessarily associate widespread homelessness with Sonoma County, but I gather from some of the articles that I've read that it's a big problem there. How large is the homeless community in Sonoma?
It's quite large. Figures vary from 2,000 to 11,000. The homeless people basically tell us that all of the official counts are way low, that they don't get to the people who are living in the back hills and in the woods. So that's where the 11,000 figure comes. But we do know that even the official homeless count they do every year shows a very high rate in Sonoma County per population. Our homeless rate is 7.7 per 1,000. Now, the U.S. average is 2.1 per 1,000. And just in California, it's 5.4. So wow. Compared to most cities, 5.4, we have 7.7, almost 8 people every 1,000 people who are homeless.
And are they concentrated in certain parts of the county, certain communities?
They're everywhere. I mean, that is a lot of people. And most homeless people, as you probably know, try to stay invisible. So, but even in now very affluent and wealthy areas, you'll see people sleeping outside at night in a bush, in around a corner, behind a store. So they do tend to concentrate their services in Santa Rosa, which is the biggest city. So there's a nice group of people that stayed pretty much close to there. And then there's people who live out in the river, which is a traditionally poor area. And there's more sort of for the outdoors types of homeless people. There's hiding places and things. But they're everywhere.
What is driving it? As you've worked with people, no doubt you've heard their stories. You know, are these like laid off tech workers, or are they people who have been itinerant in some way for many years? Are they a mix of those? You mentioned mental illness. Is mental illness a big contributor? Or some people say, well, if mental illness caused homelessness, then, you know, 2/3 of the U.S. population would be homeless. So,
Well, just think of poverty. You know, you take who is poor and who's most likely to become homeless, and that's who becomes homeless. So there's multiple reasons people get there. But the biggest one that they tell surveyors and so on is the job loss. That's the thing that kicks them over the edge. We have a large population of homeless youth there. And of course, one of the main reasons that people are it is so high in Sonoma County is all the rents, and it's just a very expensive place to live. 80% of the homeless in Sonoma County live there at the time they became homeless, and only 6% come from outside of California. So this idea that people are coming to your county to take advantage of the services or even of the weather is actually not true.
And are a lot of people going in and out of homelessness?
Absolutely. People get into something that's maybe they get a room in a house, but it doesn't work out. They get into some low-income place and there's disgusting conditions. People do a circuit of the shelters and the other kinds of places where they try to help homeless people. So you go live somewhere for 6 months in a sort of dormitory, and then you're done. They say, okay, you can only be here 6 months because we have more people that need to be here. And then you go to the next place. You can live years just going around doing what one of my friends calls the shelter merry-go-round.
How much relationship is there between domestic violence and homelessness, especially for women?
It's definitely a factor, very much a factor. One of the members of our group is a domestic violence activist because of her life.
You mentioned youth. How much of the youth are queer? I know that nationwide and certainly in this area, a high percentage of homeless youth are queer youth.
I don't have an answer to that. I know there's a large percentage. I know there's many queer people, queer kids. We have a really active organization, SAY, who does youth work, and they work with Voices, which is also a queer youth, and not necessarily homeless, but sort of at-risk youth. So there's a lot of overlap, and there's a lot of acceptance among homeless kids and young people that queerness is kind of like part of the landscape.
So talk about some of the work that you've participated in, and also I gather that you've been instrumental in the last few years in kind of designing and driving some of it.
Well, I don't want to take too much credit. There's quite a team, and it includes people who are in the social service agencies that are kind of frustrated at the pace and the constraints. It includes religious folks from various congregations, and then just people like me that care a lot. And the name of our organization is Homeless Action because people wanted to do action. And we are a grassroots group. We don't have a budget. We don't get money from state and local governments. So we're not beholden. You know, we can stand up in the city council meetings and say the things that other people can't, same as in the county meetings. And that's a lot of what we do is we lobby and say, you're not doing enough. You're not doing enough. You're not doing enough. And, oh, yes, you are not doing enough. And I think with a variety of things, including the rent increases that have happened, we now have the North Bay Organizing Project has come in very strong on rent control in Sonoma County. And the climate has changed. Both the County Board of Supervisors and the City Council in Santa Rosa have said this is our top priority, or say among our top priorities for the year.
Is some kind of rent control and eviction control?
Yeah.
So if it's the City Council's priority and the Board of Supervisors' priority, what's stopping it?
Oh, you know, competition for money. That's a big one. And everything has to be so controlled. So if we want to do a project, like say we want to put homeless people to work, you know, we want to say, we clean up this trash, we pay city workers a lot to do that. Let's ask homeless people to do it and pay them something that'll be a win-win for everyone. But, oh my gosh, we have to have an agency that does that. And the agency has to be accountable in all these various ways. And it will take us 3 months to set that up. And then we'll have to measure it and. And it allows sort of the conservative nature and inertia nature of governments to really play a big role.
But I guess specifically in terms of rent control and stopping rents from skyrocketing so much, you know, if the city council is behind that, why can't they just do it?
Oh, you're talking about landlords. The city council has put it on their agenda, and there's been at least two hearings. They voted to proceed, you know, how they work these things.
Whatever that means.
So there was a fork in the road where they might have said no, and landlords really crowded that meeting and spoke very vivaciously in all these ways about it. But the city council said, we're going to go forward. What going forward means is still like, well, we'll have more hearings. We have the same issue in Healdsburg. I think that at that place, the city council has said they won't go forward on it. And we now had a big demonstration with people set up tents
Nothing like tents to drive the fear into city governments.
But, you know, it's another sign that ordinary people, you know, spearheaded by some of these groups, in that case it was the Healdsburg Peace Community that kind of got behind this. But it's really, I mean, I was amazed. The number of people driving by honked and waved, and it's a real issue on everybody's minds because everybody's so, well, almost everyone is affected. Kids and uncles and aunts and elders and, you know, everybody's afraid of losing their house.
How have the relationships been between Homeless Action and the nonprofits and service groups that, you know, do either direct service work with homeless people or direct work with the city?
They've been very careful. We certainly hear complaints from homeless people. I mean, people complain about their situation in whatever situation they're in. Homeless people deal with social service agencies, so they're you often hear, I was mistreated this way, that way. And sometimes they're right, and sometimes it's a personal interaction with two people. And, you know, we don't have the staff to go and figure that all out. But generally, we feel like the service providers are underfunded, and the staff works a lot of hours with a lot of heart. And so it's we don't try to trash them, but we do criticize, especially there's a one group, Catholic Charities, has the largest percentage of dollars and most of the programs. And we say, no, you know, that's not right. People need a variety of places to go. And so we've spoken at the city council saying, you know, spread this money around. One of the things about service providers is they get very overwhelmed because they really don't have the resources to do the things that they want to do. And the way they handle that is often by taking control of the people and saying, if you want to be in our program, oh, you have to have a job. You have to go be working on a plan. You have to be going to our financial planning workshops, whatever it is. And this, I think, is really part of the charity model that we have gotten down from the church groups in the early years, so that whether it's the gospel mission or some other group, they don't really allow the self-determination of the homeless people themselves. I mean, we're talking about adults here. They have ideas for their lives. They have plans. And even if what they want to do and how they want to do it doesn't appeal to us, it's not really our job to tell them and take control of their lives. They shouldn't have to be treated like children just because they need a place to sleep at night.
This is Women's Magazine on KPFA, 94.1 FM, and online at kpfa.org. I'm Kate Raphael, and I'm talking to Adrienne Lalby, who is one of the hosts of Pushing Limits and is an activist on homelessness in Sonoma County with the group Homeless Action. Talk about some of the gender dynamics. I guess, first of all, I think when people think of homeless people, when, you know, most people who are not homeless or haven't been in that situation visualize a homeless person, they're most likely to visualize a man of color. But I know there are a lot of homeless women. Homeless women have a tendency to be more invisible.
I'd say in Sonoma County, the stereotype is an older, scraggly white guy. And there's certainly older, scraggly white guys who are homeless, but there's a lot of women. And we just are doing this public encampment right now, and we have a lot of women there and a lot of couples. And they range in age from, I'd say, 30 to 60, 70. So there's a big age range. Now, this is not necessarily a complete snapshot of who's homeless, but one thing that we know is that women say they're afraid. You know, they're out on the street. They're trying to sleep. There's one woman who tried and tried to get into various shelters, was on waiting lists, and she ended up getting raped. And this is not unusual, really. So women are particularly at risk in that way. And I think that's partly why they've come to the camp, because it does provide that basic safety.
And do you find that sexism is an issue in the work that you do?
sexism is an issue. Sexism is always an issue. I think there's a couple ways I've seen it in the last month or so, like doing this encampment, which is the most I've actually worked directly with homeless people. There are aggressive guys. And I haven't, you know, I live a pretty, it's not exactly a middle class life, but people I work with and live with tend to be educated people. And, you know, we learn how to manipulate rather than to shout and scream. But you get people out there who are difficult people, and they will argue you to death. They will yell in your face. They will say things that you don't want to hear. And sometimes it's justified, and it's just a style of being. And sometimes it's a habit and a pattern. And so, you know, we tend to say that this kind of behavior has to change if they're going to stay in our camp, because it's just not right for the rest of the people that are there. And it's not always men, but mostly.
And have you found that people do change or can change?
Sometimes, yeah. I mean, it's kind of sad, really, but when you're providing something that is so hard to find, like the police won't bother you if you stay in this tent instead of 100 feet away, that's a pretty big incentive.
What's this encampment, you know, sort of how long is it? How long has it been going? How long is it going to be going? And what are its goals?
We had gone to all these government agencies that we want to do a public encampment. People are camped everywhere. So let's do one where the police don't come. Let's do one to sort of demonstrate that people don't need a lot of oversight from social service agencies. And they just kind of ignored us, I'd say, is the polite way to say it. So a month ago, we took over a parking lot behind an unused county water agency building. And we just set up 20 tents. We had 3 or 4 homeless people working with us. And within a week, we had 20 people living there. The water agency and the board of supervisor representative who runs the water agency, they were there the first day. The police were there the first night. Police came in, looked, and said, oh, okay, good. They left. The board of supervisors fellow and the water agency people were like, you know what? This isn't right. This isn't really the way you should do these things. But we kind of understand and we kind of respect what you're doing. So we've had ongoing conversations. They made us move from one parking lot to another. We're supposed to be done with that parking lot in the week before Thanksgiving. But they agreed that we could be there until then. And
what's so magic about the week before Thanksgiving?
Well, they don't really want to kick out a bunch of homeless people in the rain on Thanksgiving. That would be very bad publicity.
But why do they need the parking lot on Thanksgiving?
Well, they're trying to sell the building. So they think they need us gone so they can show it to buyers. But, you know, I think we're in it for the long haul. We're building platforms for the tents now so that people be up off the ground for the rain. And this is a community. And people who come, their minds are changed because it's clean, it's peaceful. It's sort of like a little jolt. You go, you have your expectation, whatever they are, and you come to the camp and you go, oh, hey, this is nothing. And so, you know, I think we're going to either find another place to live, move. Our ultimate goal is to have these all over the county because there are people who need to be inside and safe this winter. I mean, a tent is not exactly inside, but it's doable. It only cost us $1,500 to set this up.
Wow. So, I mean, is this our future? Is people living in tents around the country? Because homelessness is this huge problem everywhere in this country. People are starting to wake up to the reality that we have all these people who can't afford housing. And yet, I mean, I just found out I'm going to need to move. And, I mean, looking at apartment prices. Look, I would never have predicted 5 years ago when I moved into the place I live now that rents would be pretty much double what they were then, and they don't seem to be stopping, and we don't seem to see real solutions being explored.
Well,
or
There are real solutions, I'm glad to say. But in terms of what you were just talking about, we have two members of our group, one who has a Section 8 voucher, which, you know, is kind of the gold standard for poverty. If you have that, you can find a house. Well, he has to move out of Sonoma County. He's going to move to Vallejo. Rent control is the first line of defense. And we have rent control activists now in Alameda, and Richmond just passed a really strong or solid rent control ordinance. We need to go to the state level, because the last time that the landlords got rid of rent control, they put a state law in that really limits what cities can do. But I think you're going to see in the next, two or three years, a lot of rent control measures, and hopefully the end of that state limits.
Is somebody working on changing that state law?
Tenants Together is the state organization to look to. And, you know, we sort of one of those things where you need a mass movement to make it happen. You need a lot more than just a group.
A whole group.
Right.
Yeah.
But I want to say there's two other big things, which is when Ronald Reagan became president, he cut the Housing and Urban Development Money Agency in half. And those are the people who built low-income housing. So that's HUD. If you've heard of it, it's HUD. That money has never been replaced. You know, we've had Democrats in there. Democrats have run the country, and that money is still 75% of what it was when Reagan was in charge. So we have many years of money to make up in building low-income housing, and we need to have a nice chunk of ongoing money that just does this. So poor people, I mean, housing is a human right, especially in this country where we have so much money. It's absurd that people live on the street. So that's the federal level. Then there's the state and local level. Sonoma County, and I give the county supervisors a lot of props for this, they're going to build 2,200 units of low-income housing. Not housing, low-income housing. It'll cost them $110 million, which they have to raise. You know, it won't all come from their budget. Other cities have to pitch in. And so they're doing a 10-year project for that. That'll take a big chunk out of homelessness in the county. What happened, though, is that the city and the counties had redevelopment money. And when Jerry Brown took the redevelopment money to make up a state deficit, all of that money went away. So we had a low-income builder. They were building 250 units a year. That's a nice pace. You know, you maybe make it up to 500 units a year, and you start to get really good. Well, that money all went away. So for some reason, Jerry Brown is not into housing. His entire career, he's not funded affordable housing. So that's another effort where the state needs to kick in back to the cities money to do this work.
You know, I think a lot of people want to do something to help homeless people, you know, feel bad about homelessness. So, you know, a lot of people volunteer at soup kitchens on Thanksgiving, you know, or people take clothes to shelters or take blankets to parks where people camp out, you know, because I think people feel like they want that personal connection. You know, some of the political work that you're talking about is less immediately gratifying. I think if somebody doesn't have a lot of time and is going to do one thing, what would you say should be the highest priority?
Get to know a homeless person. Just plain get to know somebody. But I do want to talk about our camp model, because Camp Michaela is named after a homeless woman who was murdered. She was on a waiting list to be in a shelter, 3 days away from it, middle of the night. Some random guy killed her. So Camp Michaela, this is something you could do on a neighborhood level. You need about 10 people. Then you need this $1,500, which isn't that hard for 10 people to raise. You buy the tents. You find your local spot where, hopefully, where there's not a lot of neighbors around, where it's fairly quiet. But there's a lot of empty spots, including buildings, that can be used for this purpose. And I'd be very happy to work with someone. We kind of think you need one or two people to sort of spearhead the actual camp for the first month, because you can't expect people to just come in and get along.
Self-manage,
yeah. I mean, now it's a month into it, and we're starting to see we have a camp council now, three very, very capable people. We have rules against drinking on site and using drugs on site, and some of these behavioral rules, they were hard to enforce in the first week or two.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask about that. I mean, how do you enforce rules like that, because that certainly was a problem at some of the Occupy camps.
We basically have asked people to leave. We had one guy who was immediately not the right guy, and we kind of had to shoo him away a few times, which it's extremely painful, I have to say. It's really, really hard. And then there was another man who came in and did the intake form, and it just became pretty obvious that he wasn't going to work out there. And we actually had to rent a U-Haul and offer to take his stuff somewhere else for him. But he did, you know, and at some point, I've been surprised. People basically, if you just say it again and again, this isn't going to work out. I guess people are used to accepting the reality of things.
So I actually read that one of your projects is to, or was last year, maybe you succeeded, was to get public bathrooms to be open 24 hours a day.
Yeah, that was our second project, and it is ongoing. We did get the city council to say, yes, this is a good thing, and the city staff tried to take it off the list, and they put it back on. We asked them to put up a porta potty in every park, and there's a lot of little pocket parks. You know, as a disabled person, one of the things I have is incontinence, and I want a bathroom handy. And it's very clear to me that all these businesses that say, you know, no customers only, I got to dress a certain way if I want to use their bathroom. There's a city, El Paso, which requires all businesses that are open to the public to keep their bathrooms open for all during their business hours. That'd go a long way to alleviating this problem.
Yeah, and of course it would make sense, because if everybody did it, then no one business would be like the place where the bathroom's always full. And, you know, that's sort of what I think businesses worry about is like, well, if nobody else is doing it and we let everybody who wants to use our bathroom, then our customers will never be able to get in the bathroom.
Thank you. Thank you for making that point. That's so, exactly yeah. Right. But actually what they're afraid of is the odd person who comes in and trashes. So one thing you have is this population that are basically outlawed. You know, they're the underclass. They don't feel that invested in how beautiful your bathroom is. So you get occasionally someone who does drugs in the bathroom or tears the toilet thing off the wall. And that's just the cost of doing business, you know. Sometimes you have to clean up.
So how did you become an activist?
I was raised in Nebraska as a family of 10 kids. I was the oldest girl. So my mother taught me to take care of the younger ones because obviously she couldn't do it all. And that was my life as a caretaker. I became an anti-war activist in college and a hippie and then a feminist. And for a lot of years, it was kind of in that framework of taking care of things. Things need to be done. And, you know, my mother was active in the church, and sometimes my work was very similar to what she did, making dinners for people, organizing people, and so on. But over time, I got politicized, and I start to see, you know, feminism really was a big, big piece of that, that this is a systemic situation. This is, you know, racism is institutionalized. It's not just that you should take care of a nice black person and feel good about yourself. You really have to struggle and do things on the national, local, and in a conscious way, because we're trying to change culture and laws.
And when did you get involved at KPFA?
I came to KPFA after when I became disabled in my 30s, and I had this asthma. I was sick night after night after. I knew all of the KPFA hosts. I mean, they were my best friends. I talked to them. I listened to them. I didn't talk to them. They were all in the radio. But at some point during the 99 struggle against the old board that was trying to take over things, we had a public meetings, and I organized a disability meeting because I thought that was missing, and I was feeling a lot better at that point, so I could do something. And I was shocked. You know, we came to this meeting. All these disabled people came and said, yes, that's right. We love KPFA, but disability is missing. And I thought, okay, now they'll fix that. Well, they didn't. They basically said, oh, would you like to try to have a program?
So did you have some people in your group who knew how to do radio, or how did you figure out how to go from, we think you should have a radio program, to we're making a radio program?
We went like, oh, what the heck? Okay, we can do this. And yeah, we basically just studied and learned and put together a pilot. So we had meetings for, I think, a year, and then it took us a year to do a pilot because we really had no skills at all.
But then somehow you managed to evolve, so you were doing, I think you were doing every other week for a while, and now are you on every week?
No, we're the first, third, and fifth Friday afternoons at 2:30 for just a half an hour. And one of the things one of my mentors said early on was, pick a chunk that you can really do and do well. So we've been offered to expand it a couple of different times, but this is something we feel good about, and it doesn't stress us out. You know, we're sick. So we have to have a little bit of flexibility in how to do stuff. I shouldn't say we're sick, because some of us have very stable disabilities, but limited.
And the studio is not always the most easy place to get to or the most accessible.
It's the biggest problem we've had is blind access. And it's hard to keep the software for blind access to be really there, and especially in this studio where we're sitting today, no one has ever tried even to make it accessible. So we've had a lot of blind hosts and producers, and they work from their homes most of the time, which is good. You know, I mean, it's good that that's available. A decade or so ago, all of this wasn't possible because the digital stuff hadn't really happened yet.
Adrienne Lalby's been my guest. She is one of the hosts and producers of Pushing Limits on KPFA, and she has just been given an award, recognized with an award from the Sonoma County Task Force for the Homeless for her work with homeless action in Sonoma County. Adrienne, thanks so much.
Thank you, Kate. It's been great.